Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In cities and states where we have the data, there is a clear pattern. African Americans are dying of coronavirus at the highest rates. Take Milwaukee County in Wisconsin. African Americans there account for only 26% of the population and more than 70% of COVID-19-related deaths. Or Chicago. African Americans make up 32% of the city's population and nearly 70% of deaths. Here's Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot.
Those numbers take your breath away. They really do. This is a call to action moment for all of us. When we talk about equity and inclusion, they're not just nice notions. They are an imperative that we must embrace as a city. And we see this even more urgently when we look at these numbers and this disparity. It's unacceptable. No one should think that this is okay.
Well, this hour on Point, we're talking about the disproportionate toll of the coronavirus on the African-American community and the pre-existing social conditions in America that underlie it. And we'll begin today with Kat Stafford. She's the national race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press, and she joins us from Detroit, Michigan via Skype. Kat, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, tell us what you've seen there in Detroit already in terms of the toll that COVID-19 is taking on the African-American community.
So coronavirus has really hit the city of Detroit hard. We have seen more than 5,800 cases alone and 247 deaths in the city. The toll is unimaginable. And beyond the numbers, I've written stories about the people who we have actually lost. We are losing community pillars. We are losing law enforcement individuals. We are losing people at every facet of this community. And it's hard. It's hard to see this. As I told someone else, these are people that I have interviewed for quite a long time that are passing away from this virus. So when you talk about the toll, it's hitting everyone.
Right. I mean, it seems as if in the African-American community, everyone at least knows someone, whether in their direct family or, as you're saying, these community leaders. So it's really shocking. Is there any sense or how is this being discussed in the community there about why this is happening?
That's a great question. In the community, everyone wants to know, why is this hitting us so hard? And so the AP yesterday, we published one of the first actual looks at how this is impacting African Americans across the country. And really, it's a multitude of issues. It's not just the fact that African Americans seem to be more likely to develop issues such as asthma, hypertension, or heart disease. You have to look at the underlying factors here that factor into that, such as poverty and really systemic racism and inequity in the healthcare system and how all of that fits into this. So it's a really complicated answer, but it's something that we really need to start looking at.
And just to point out again, you're the national race and ethnicity reporter for the AP, but I do want to just sort of reflect with you for a moment, Kat, about the fact that you're a native of Detroit, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And so what has it been like for you watching this happen to your city?
So, you know, most reporters leave their hometowns and go report elsewhere. But for me, I have been able to fortunately stay within this community. And when you see this neighborhood that you've lived in so long be hit by this virus, when you see neighbors and family friends dealing with loved ones who are in the hospital, it really brings all of this into sharp focus for me. And it lets me know that is so crucial for us to really focus on how race is a huge part of this. You cannot talk about this pandemic without talking about race in America and what led us to this point. Mm-hmm. The fact that African American communities are more likely to be in close proximity to industrial areas, which in turn can lead to these high asthma rates that we see in our children. Or the fact that in the city of Detroit, since 2014, there have been more than 127,000 water service disconnections. Now, the city just started to restore this water service for people who have lost water over time. But again, as you have city officials saying you need to wash your hands, how can you do that without water? So being of this community and from this community, for me, I have really tried to elevate those voices so really the nation can see what's happening.
So can we just talk a little bit more about those water service disconnections? Because I feel like it is a perfect example of the big structural issues here, right, that coronavirus is shining a bright light on. You said 127,000 water disconnections?
Yes. Since 2014 in the city of Detroit alone. And really, I had a story that ran in late March that looked at water shutoffs across the nation. And one of the things that really stuck with me in this story was I spoke with the Reverend who has a food pantry in Detroit. And she told me in 2014, she recalls children coming to her pantry with empty pitchers. She was like, what is this about? They were coming to her because their homes had no water. And so when you fast forward to 2020 and realize that there were people living without water, that's a serious challenge when you're trying to fight this pandemic. So we have a lot of water advocates and elected officials who have been fighting for years to get this issue resolved in the city. And in fact, Congress members Rashida Tlaib, Debbie Dingell, and others were urging Congress to take action on this very issue because, like I said, it's a nationwide problem.
Yeah, absolutely. But in terms of then connecting the structural inequities to what public health officials are saying that people ought to do to help keep themselves safe, right? As you pointed out, like one of the first things we've been told for months now is wash your hands a lot. But if you don't even have running water in your homes, obviously that's just not possible, as you're saying. So has there been a coming together of public health officials and sort of water authorities to get more people who maybe have current shutoffs to get their water back online? Has anything been done about this?
Yes. So the city of Detroit has started this water restart plan to get people's service connected. But what they ran into was there were a number of households who had incomplete plumbing in their homes that made it very hard for them to restore water. So that's another challenge that we have. We found that Black and Hispanic households across the nation are more likely to have incomplete plumbing in their homes. But thankfully, the governor there, Gretchen Whitmer, Michigan governor, she has signed an executive order demanding that all communities in the state of Michigan turn on water. So right now what we're seeing is people coming together to try to identify these households so that they could get their services back on.
Okay. Well, Kat, stand by here for just a second because I want to now play a little bit of how the president of the United States, how President Trump responded to this emerging truth that the African-American community is being hit disproportionately by COVID-19. Here is what the president said at Tuesday's daily White House task force briefing.
We're trying to find out why is it that it's three and four times. Now, maybe that's not going to be the final number, but why is it three or four times more so for the Black community as opposed to other people? It doesn't make sense, and I don't like it.
President Donald Trump on Tuesday. Well, joining us now from Brooklyn, New York, is Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's an investigative reporter covering racial injustice for The New York Times Magazine. She's creator of the 1619 Project as well. Nicole, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So the president there asking, why is this happening to the Black community as opposed to others? What would be your response for him?
Well, the fact that Black communities are suffering from both infection and death rates in a disproportionate way is actually very predictable when we understand the social circumstances that we've created in communities all across this country. This is knowable. And of course, I have engaged pretty frequently on Twitter about what are the reasons. We know that Black Americans are the most likely to have to take public transit of all racial and ethnic groups. So are not able to contain themselves within their vehicles and are necessarily being exposed because they're having to take transit with a lot of other people. We know that Black Americans disproportionately work in the service sector, meaning they come in contact with members of the public who are not related to them to a much larger degree and are often in kind of these public-facing service roles, working over the counter, working mm-hmm. at airports, driving buses, postal service. So that meant that Black people were much more likely to get exposed. We know that Black people are the least likely to own their own homes, meaning they are living often in rental properties, multifamily housing. So there were a multitude of factors that led to the higher infection rates. And then we know just in general, Black Americans suffer from the type of health effects that make coronavirus so deadly at the highest rates of all groups. Black and Native Americans have the highest rates of asthma, the highest rates of diabetes, the highest rates of hypertension, and all of these are caused by living in higher levels of poverty in neighborhoods that are consistently located in the highest pollutant areas. Stress, cortisol, when you live in high-stress mm-hmm. environments, your body releases a hormone called cortisol, which tends to also make you gain weight. Black people live in areas where it's harder to get healthy food. And we've seen a lot of conversation about Black people having higher obesity rates. But what we don't understand is obesity is not just about how many calories you take in. It's about the type of calories. So there's kind of a tsunami of effects that every day, Black people, whether they're low income, middle income, and even higher income, have to deal with that made this in some ways very predictable. So when Trump says he doesn't understand this, he can just talk to the epidemiologists working mm-hmm. at federal agencies, and they know why. And we all can figure this out pretty easily.
Well, Nicole Hannah-Jones and Kat Stafford, hang on here for just a second, because there is a lot more to discuss when we come back. We are talking about the disproportionate impact that COVID-19 is having on the African-American community in this country and what that really says about the social inequities in America. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the disproportionate impact that the COVID-19 global pandemic is having on the African-American community in the United States. I'm joined today by Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's investigative reporter covering racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine and creator of the 1619 Project. And Kat Stafford is with us. She's national race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press. Now, On Point also spoke with Dr. Giselle Corby-Smith. She's a professor of social medicine at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. She's also director of the UNC Center for Health Equity Research. And she told us that African Americans are more likely to have pre-existing conditions that increase their probability or vulnerability to dying from COVID-19 due to the structural inequities we've been talking about.
Oftentimes, we tend to land on what people eat and drink, exercise, etc. But the reality is, while those things are true, the communities that people live in structure the opportunities to be able to live a healthy life. So you need to have places to walk and places to buy fresh fruits and vegetables. We know that those structural factors are a key factor in and actually probably take up more than 50% of the reason that racial and ethnic minorities have higher chronic conditions.
Dr. Corby-Smith also told us that oftentimes healthcare providers working in these at-risk communities are from the community themselves.
We also know that there's going to be a financial and human toll on these already strained practices and healthcare systems that are caring for some of our most vulnerable populations. And it's going to be staggering. And in fact, might actually lead to closing some of these facilities and practices that are caring for the communities that are at some of the greatest need.
So that's Dr. Giselle Corby-Smith at the University of North Carolina. Nicole Hannah-Jones and Kat Stafford, I was going to hold off on the question that's pounding in my head, but I'm just going to cut right to the chase, okay? Because for anybody who has paid any kind of attention to structural inequities in American society, to racial inequities in American society, this should not come as a surprise, right? Because the vulnerabilities are already there. They're baked into how this country operates. I think what sort of perplexes me is why, for example, from some leaders, we are hearing a note of surprise. I mean, that's the thing that I'm just like, why? Why is anybody surprised about this? Doesn't that sort of make you step back a little, Kat?
Yeah, and just to the point that the doctor just made about how these communities don't have access to healthy food. Just going back to Detroit, there's a large number of Detroiters who do not have transportation. They rely on the bus system. And so when you're talking about cities that have these food deserts, how can you obtain healthy food if you're just relying on the corner store, if you're relying on the McDonald's that's down the street that you can walk to? This is what's contributing to this. And when you think about the fact that Detroit is home to the most polluted zip code in the entire state of Michigan, you have to realize this is where these asthma rates could be coming from. You have to look at the fact that, again, these communities are in these areas that have all of these systemic inequity issues that are contributing to what we're seeing. And so I just think it's really important to note that, yes, it's easy to point to these health issues, but you have to understand, how did we get here?
Right, exactly. And so, Nicole, that's why I'm wondering, does the fact that there is this note of surprise from political leaders, does that actually sort of say more than does it say more about how we haven't really done enough or all that much to address those inequities than anything else?
Yeah, absolutely. What this says is that the same communities whose conditions have been ignored lead people to be surprised that they are suffering from conditions that makes this virus more deadly. I think what is so critical in this conversation is to understand that the inequalities that we're speaking about, they are structural. They are man-made. They are created. The fact that Black Americans to this day live in the most segregated of all racial groups, that they have the least access to trauma centers, that across the medical field, they still face discrimination where studies have shown that doctors think Black people don't feel as much pain, that Black people are less likely to get the type of testing that they need when they come in and present with illness. When we look at the fact that many Black people could not ever social distance because they are the ones who are working in the service sector, then we should not be surprised. But we have long accepted these inequalities. We have long accepted, you know, one of the things I think that's most glaring is we were told before the virus really came to the United States that this was a virus that struck and killed older people. But what we didn't take into consideration was the fact that Black Americans face so much stress in their day-to-day lives, and this has been proven by science, that they have what's called a weathering effect, which means Black people are getting the types of diseases, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, that you usually only see presenting in older populations. And so when we started seeing younger Americans dying from this disease, it was shocking. What we weren't hearing was that these younger Americans were very heavily Black. And that's because Black people are suffering. America makes Black people suffer from disease at a younger age that usually only kills older Americans. So this ignoring of the disastrous health circumstances that so many Black Americans live in is very typical. And I think that's why people who don't study this, but really don't think about how so many Black people have to live day to day are surprised by this. But those of us who study this for a living are not surprised at all. That's why so many people were saying we've got to see the racial data on this, because it was covering up the racial inequality that Americans face every day.
Right. And we're still getting that data somewhat piecemeal, I should say. Right. And we it'll be sobering to see what emerges when bigger data sets and more information about who is getting sick and who's being killed by this comes forward. But I want you mentioned about the challenges of even accessing healthcare in some portions of the African American community across this country. On that note, we received a voicemail from an On Point listener, Richard, a clergyman in Dayton, Ohio, and he told us that the closure of Good Samaritan Hospital in Dayton has really hit the African American community the hardest.
This hospital was in this community for about 100 years, serving the African American community of about 35,000 people, displacing 1,600 workers. Now that Blacks across the country, Dayton not excluded, as being affected by the deaths among African Americans at a high rate, higher than any other ethnic group or white group, that this hospital was sorely needed. It was a 450-bed hospital.
That's Richard, a clergyman in Dayton, Ohio, who left us that voicemail. I'd like to bring into the conversation now Dr. Utibe Essien. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and he joins us today from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Dr. Essien, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, pick up on the point that Richard, our On Point listener, shared with us about challenges about just accessing healthcare, even emergency healthcare in some of these communities. How prevalent is that?
Right. No, Richard is certainly correct there, and one of the big drivers, along with the important social determinants that have been brought up at the start of this call, or conversation rather, we know that African Americans have poor access to health care based on limited insurance access, but also just where the hospitals are located. We've boldly or commonly heard about the white flight of living in residential areas, but a similar phenomenon is occurring in hospitals and healthcare systems where those hospitals are moving from urban areas into suburban areas and leaving African Americans, particularly in the South, without clear access to healthcare. I think is important to note beyond just hospital closures is the way that the health system has completely gone virtual for the most part, and especially in the outpatient setting. And now these individuals who largely depended on community health centers to access health care no longer have that access as readily available, whether because they have limited access to telehealth or because they just physically can't get to the emergency departments that are located at further distances. So I believe Richard's point is certainly an important one to consider.
So limited access to telehealth, meaning everything from perhaps not having broadband to not having, you know, an adequate number of digital devices to meet the needs of a family, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So you also mentioned insurance access, and I wanted to ask you about how that might have played into testing, right? Because we still have this problem in the United States of not having had enough people tested or still not having enough people being tested to know who has been exposed to the novel coronavirus, especially if they have to pay for the test. So is this is this also one of those compounding complications in the African American community?
Oh, certainly. The conversation earlier revolved around poverty, yeah. And we know that poor individuals are less likely to be insured. Those who are employed are. We just saw another report today that another 6 million individuals lost their employment who are depending on their employment for insurance are also now in the setting where they don't have access to insurance and thus have limited access to health care. And I certainly do think that that played a role in testing. Some early reports came out saying that the predominant testing early on were happening in suburban neighborhoods, wealthier neighborhoods, neighborhoods that had closer access to well-resourced academic medical centers. But as the information has shifted, as this race data is coming in, we clearly see that individuals who are able to eventually get into the emergency department and ended up being the sickest from this disease, unfortunately, did happen to be Black and likely poorer as well.
Mm. Well, so Kat Stafford and Nicole Hannah-Jones, let me turn back to you. Kat, first of all, I just wondered if you had any reflections or any responses to what Dr. Essien was saying about sort of just access to medical care, insurance, things like that in the African-American community.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that this is a critical piece of this. I mean, we've seen in the city of Detroit alone that access to testing has been a huge barrier. I will hope that other cities take a page out of Detroit's book, though. What they just recently started to do was allow doctors who may not ordinarily take these patients, they have been accepting people without insurance, to write them prescriptions in order for them to get tested. Because in the early days, there were a lot of people that were reaching out to me and others saying, how can I get my grandmother tested? I think she has COVID, but she has no insurance. Mm. And you could not get tested without this prescription. And again, it also goes back to transportation, because if you don't have a car and you live in a city like Detroit that does not have a robust transportation system, it's very hard for you to get to these testing sites. And in a recent story that we just published yesterday, we talked to a Milwaukee man who said that he was dealing with this issue of not having what he was saying trusted by a medical professional. He thought he had COVID-19. He had trouble breathing. He could barely get up. But they repeatedly told him, no, you just have the flu. So this is a frustration that's being felt across the nation in terms of Black and brown individuals who believe and have data. We have data that shows us that they're not believed when they go to these systems and tell them about their symptoms and what they're dealing with.
Yeah. Nicole, I'm going to come to you in a second, but Dr. Essien, regarding what Kat just said, we've heard over the past several weeks on this show that sort of people not being believed or turned around and said, you know, we can't test you, won't test you, you just have the flu. We've heard that a lot from various communities. But I think Kat is also making a really important point that there was already this extant problem of African Americans not being believed by medical care, medical providers, and then also that generating probably an understandable lack of trust, right? That some African American patients might have with the healthcare system. How does that compound the problems now?
certainly. I think along with poverty, the single most important issue around this pandemic in Black communities is the issue of trust. We have a long history of distrust in the healthcare system in the African-American community, rightfully so, whether it's from experimentation in the past all the way through to limited access to pain treatment in the present. And I believe that African-American communities or individuals in those communities just thinking, oh, I probably not going to be tested, the doctor might not believe me, and now potentially seeing some of that play out in actual data where some of my colleagues are actually showing underreportedness of certain racial populations and communities in terms of coming in with symptoms and not leaving with a test around the country. It certainly is compounding the issue, and certainly not something that we can fix today. But as we address this pandemic overall, I think developing methods to really improve trust in our communities is going to be a large, important factor in addressing this issue.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, do you want to respond to that?
I think that is often the case. I don't know that I have anything additional to add to that.
Okay. Well, so then let me ask you then about there are one thing we haven't discussed is, for example, the people who are incarcerated in the United States or the population of people who are without a home. African Americans are overrepresented in both of those communities, and they are particularly vulnerable right now. I mean, that's also part of the picture here.
Yeah. So, if we understand that the general inequalities that Black Americans face are largely invisible to people in power, then the inequalities of Black people who are homeless and who are in prison, we just don't want to talk about them at all. I mean, we have had an emerging issue at Rikers in New York for weeks now, where activists have been begging leadership to release people, many people who are not even in Rikers on a crime. They had a technical probation violation from prison. And that has fallen largely on deaf ears. I think we have a general lack of empathy for people who are incarcerated. And part of so much of the language and the response around coronavirus is, well, this isn't anyone's fault. So we need to provide assistance to Americans because Americans didn't bring this on themselves. And I think we have a different sense when we talk about people who are incarcerated or homeless, that somehow they are responsible for the circumstance that they're in. And so we don't need to treat them with the urgency that they deserve. And I think I saw an article yesterday that jails in Chicago are actually now a new hotspot. And people are in untenable conditions on your best day, when people are living in unsanitary conditions, having to share toilets, being confined to small spaces. And with a deadly disease like this, I think we are going to see really devastating numbers.
Well, Nicole Hannah-Jones and Kat Stafford and Dr. Utube Essien, stand by for a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, it will be the week in review on this show, and we'll be talking about the latest in the number of cases of novel coronavirus of COVID-19 in the United States. We'll be taking a look at the response from both the federal and state level over the course of the week and, of course, the economic impact as well. And we want to hear from you. So how have you felt this week the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic? What's your question about your state or the federal, your state's response or the federal government's response? Give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Well, today we are talking about the disproportionate impact that COVID-19 is having on the African-American community in this country and what that really says about the underlying social inequities that were already in long existence here in the United States. And I'm joined today by Nicole Hannah-Jones, by Kat Stafford, and by Dr. Utibe Essien as well. And I want to play this voicemail that we received from an On Point listener, Emma. She's an emergency room nurse in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
There's been a lot of discussion on a global scale of when there's a shortage of ventilators, who gets them. They look at age, but also at comorbidities such as asthma, hypertension, heart disease, and diabetes as reasons that patients would have less of a chance of survival and therefore not be placed on a ventilator. In our country, due to these disparities in health, these conditions disproportionately affect Black and Brown people. Is there a way America can make these terribly hard choices about who gets a vent and therefore a chance at surviving while taking this into account?
That's Emma, an On Point listener and an ER nurse in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dr. Essien, I wanted to play that and get your response to it, because it seems like what Emma is saying is that if in an emergency department they're triaging patients and choosing who or may have to choose who gets ventilators and who doesn't based on those already existing comorbidities that we've been talking about, that this again could disproportionately impact Black patients. Is that a possibility, Dr. Essien?
No, I think Emma asks a really important and critical question, and one that many of my colleagues and I are starting to think about already, about the other side of the pandemic where patients are actually being hospitalized and treated. What happens at these end-of-life stages when individuals are need to be placed on ventilators? There's been several pieces, both in the medical literature as well as the news media around rationing and learning from Italy about how they use the utilitarian approaches to this question. And while those may seem good, those may seem important, they've also recommended the use of triage committees. We know based on the factors that our listener Emma brought up that these chronic conditions are more prevalent in Black Americans, whether it's hypertension, diabetes, asthma that was brought up, obesity, all the factors that unfortunately put individuals at higher risk of complications from this disease and ultimately requiring ventilation. And if we don't address right now, today, the standards of care around determination and rationing of ventilators, we are going to see Black and African Americans continue to die from this disease at higher rates than we expected. We can look to issues around transplantation and see how chronic disease influences whether individuals get heart, lung, or liver transplants. And that's yet another area that, of scarcity, rather, that our health system has to deal with. So I believe there are a lot of lessons that we can already learn to see that, unfortunately, this is just yet another area that has the potential to exacerbate these disparities.
I mean, I just want to say the obvious. That is terrible, right? First of all, we don't want to reach a point where we have to be making these decisions. I wish we had enough ventilators to begin with. But the idea that we may reach a point where life, literally life and death decisions are being made based on these comorbidities, what we're saying here is it's putting potentially an entire group of Americans at death's door. I mean, is that too grim a way of putting it, Dr. Essien?
No, I think you're exactly right, and I think that your call and your the kind of emotion in your voice, so to speak, is exactly what Black physicians of color, Hispanic physicians, Asian physicians, all of us are thinking about. We're thinking about the communities like Dr. Corby Smith mentioned that we not only grew up in, but we are currently working in, and wondering what is going to happen to the individuals that we see on the street every day, to our family members, if really this is going to be the way that if things get to this point, unfortunately, hopefully they don't, that care is going to be handled. And unfortunately, we just have a unfortunate track record of that, of things potentially going in that direction based on the history of medicine.
Mm. All right. So I want to talk now, focus on solutions or opportunities here, if we can. So first of all, let's just listen to, for example, what Dr. Anthony Fauci said at Tuesday's White House Coronavirus Task Force briefing, his view about why the African-American community is seeing these higher mortality rates.
Unfortunately, when you look at the predisposing conditions that lead to a bad outcome with coronavirus, the things that get people into ICUs that require intubation and often lead to death, they are just those very comorbidities that are unfortunately disproportionately prevalent in the African American population. So we're very concerned about that. It's very sad. It's nothing we can do about it right now except to try and give them the best possible care to avoid those complications.
It's Dr. Anthony Fauci on Tuesday saying that perhaps there's nothing we can do about the structural inequities right now in the middle of a pandemic. Here's what Dr. Corby Smith, you heard her a little earlier in the show, from the University of North Carolina Center for Health Equity Research, told us when we spoke with her yesterday, that she sees this as an opportunity to address structural racism in this country.
If one community is at risk, then all of us are going to be at risk, and because of the way our systems are tied together. This is an opportunity for us to reshape and rethink our public health system, so that we can actually provide and create opportunities so everyone can lead a healthy life.
That's Dr. Corby Smith from the University of North Carolina Center for Health Equity Research. Kat Stafford, is this an opportunity?
I think it is an opportunity. But I think, again, we have to start with talking about how we got to this point. Mm-hmm. And about these, have a very honest conversation about these inequities. And also, I think the data is going to be crucial in this. Even having hospitals, so one expert I spoke with from Columbia University, as she said, why don't we see the hospitals openly sharing data on who's getting ventilators, who are getting these life-saving measures? Let's break it down by these demographics. That's going to be important. So I think starting with the data gathering and, again, having this very honest conversation about what are we doing with these resources? How also are we reaching these communities? How are we reaching Black folks to make sure that they have the proper materials that they need to protect themselves? And going back to what Nicole said earlier, a lot of these people are frontline workers, but yet you really haven't seen that side of this told. A lot of Black Americans are the ones who are in the grocery stores making sure that we all have food. A lot of them are working the subway system. So how are they being protected? I think that's a crucial point that we need to address right now.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, what do you think about that?
Well, we certainly know, if we look at history, that it's only when we get these kind of periods of great disaster that we are able to make kind of substantial progress, that it takes something like this to make us do something that's been considered more radical. So the first thing I would say is that this coronavirus is magnifying the inequalities, and there's not one fix, right? Mm-hmm. We've been talking in this whole conversation about all of the disadvantages that Black Americans face, and you're not going to be able to fix all of those overnight that lead Black people to be more sick in the first place. But what I will say is the quickest thing that we could do is to implement a system of universal health care in this country that we know Black Americans have the highest rates of being uninsured. So they are least likely to be able to get the help that will be able to help them get their health problems under control. And we could solve that. We have not solved that. We are the only Western industrialized country without universal health care. And that largely has to do with our inability to get over racism. What the polling shows is that if white Americans think large numbers of Black people will benefit from a social program, they start to see their support for that social program decline. More than half of Black Americans live in the South, and the southern states were the states that largely refused to expand Medicare for the poorest citizens. So we could fix that. We could at least allow Black people to have access to health care and treatment and testing. You know, I tend to be a very pessimistic person when it comes to whether we really have the heart or will to deal with racial inequality. But if one major thing could come out of this crisis, could be that we would expand healthcare as a human right for all Americans. I think that would have been a major, major step. And perhaps this is exposing to all Americans, even those opposed to it, the need for such a change.
I share, Nicole, I have to be honest, I share, if not your pessimism, then your cynicism about the willingness of the nation to seize opportunities when they come along. Because, I mean, your research and reporting has tracked 400 years of, yes, of these inequities. And so I come back to where we began, that for anyone who has been paying attention, we have long known that there have been racial disparities that show up on virtually any access you might measure, right? From access to healthcare to net income or family net worth to life expectancy, et cetera. None of those things were enough to nudge us along, or nudge us along in a truly meaningful way. Is it possible, maybe I'm trying to battle back my own cynicism here, is it possible that the all-encompassing nature of this pandemic is something different? That is, as you said, it is a great magnifier that cannot be ignored and therefore could bring about change.
Yeah, I think that's very possible. Again, when we've seen these massive kind of societal moves forward, it's always come after a period where the harms have not been able to be contained just to the most disadvantaged communities. So the fact that all Americans, we might not be suffering the same, but nearly everyone to some degree, I think that seeing that our fates actually are tied together is what allows for transformative change. You have to be able, unfortunately, to convince a large segment of white Americans that it also will hurt them, that what is hurting Black and brown communities is also going to ultimately hurt them. And that's how you see the coalitions built to actually make transformative change. Mm.
Dr. Essien, as a physician, bring us back to sort of the more immediate term here. What are things that you'd like to see done to further assist and protect the African American community? Because now there's data that we simply cannot ignore and should not ignore about the impact it's already having. What would you do right now?
I think the way that I'm thinking about it is similar to Kat and Nicole's responses. First, we need to address the issue of testing. We need universal testing. And as the New York governor mentioned yesterday, once the race data came out of New York, testing was going to be focused on that area. The second point that we need is increased demographic data. And that's a call that I believe a number of journalists and health equity researchers and physicians are making. Without knowing where the Black, brown, yellow individuals who have COVID-19 are based, we will not be able to deploy the resources that we need to really reduce the disparities that exist right now. And those resources, I think, need to be based in the community. So my third point would be investing in the community. I know the CARES Act actually propose an award to community health centers just yesterday, emphasizing their and rather building up their ability to address COVID-19. But we also need to invest in non-health system-based community resources to really get at our communities of color, like Kat mentioned. And lastly, diversifying the workforce is a hugely important opportunity here. If African Americans are on the triage committees that are making decisions around rationing, if African Americans are in leadership for the American Medical Association, as we saw their call out for more data, I think we can continue to really push this issue forward.
And Kat Stafford, last question goes to you then. I mean, what are members of the community in Detroit right now, for example, asking for in terms of immediate next steps?
They want to know that when this pandemic fades, when we start to slowly return to normalcy, that the spotlight will still stay there. And I think the point of skepticism that you both have made is very crucial here. I mean, look at Hurricane Katrina. We know that New Orleans is still feeling the long-term effects of that, right? And look at the Great Recession and the mortgage crisis. Black Americans have yet to rebuild or rebound from that. And Black home ownership is at its lowest rate in decades, right? So when we have this conversation about the pandemic, I think it's important that we continue to look forward and continue to cover and amplify these voices, even after we start to return back to normal. Because what we know and what history has shown us is we are being disproportionately impacted right now. And the magnitude of that will continue on for many years to come.
Right. You know, here's one case in which I would say we don't want to go back to normal, right? We want to go, we want to move forward from normal at the end, from quote unquote what normal was and is for great swaths of this country when we get past this pandemic. So Kat Stafford, national race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press, with us from Detroit, Michigan. Kat, thank you so much for your reporting and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Nicole Hannah-Jones, investigative reporter covering racial injustice for the New York Times Magazine and creator of the 1619 Project, with us from Brooklyn, New York. Nicole, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for taking time on this issue.
And Utibe Essien, Dr. Essien, assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Essien, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Magna, for amplifying this issue.
And folks, tomorrow, as I said, we will be talking about the news of this week in review, the U.S. government's response, your state government's response, and the continued terrible economic impact of this global pandemic. And we want to get voicemails from you on your questions. What would you like us to talk about, and how has this week been for you in the COVID-19 pandemic? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.